Now, however, she was his. They stood under the awning at the back door of the cafe, facing a small parking area where there was only one car, an ancient silver Peugeot, most likely Sandrine's. Addison bent down and kissed Tess. And yes, it did occur to him that he'd consumed an entire bottle of wine followed by a glass of champagne. He was drunk, and so was she. The kiss could fail. It could be like kissing his little sister. But their lips connected, and there was a spark, an electric charge, a surge of attraction. The kiss was the right thing. He kissed her again, and again, and again. And then they were kissing in the back parking lot of Nu Deux. Tess's arms locked around him. He pulled her in. She was his now. Did she know this? So that there was no mistaking what all this meant, he said, "I may have just fallen in love with you, okay?" And she said, "Okay." Addison was crying now. Of course he was crying. The silly, sad tears of a little boy, though he had no recollection of feeling like this as a child. This feeling was adult. There were so many things he could never bring himself to do again. He would never go to Stowe. He would never order that bottle of Merceau. He would never eat a croque monsieur. He would never kiss anyone for the first time. He had Tess's iPhone, pilfered from the Coast Guard's bag of her personal effects. He felt guilty for stealing it. But then, guess what? The chief called to inform him that he was the executor of the McAvoy wills. "What?" Addison said. And because his memories of Tess started this past December, it took a while to come back to him. He had agreed to serve as executor. Back in 2000, when Greg and Tess bought their house on Blueberry Lane. Addison was their realtor. He was at the closing with their attorney, Barry Karsten, a big, affable fellow of Danish descent. When the papers were all signed, Barry suggested that Greg and Tess make wills. He could write them up. "Right now?" Greg said. "All you need to figure out is who you'd like to be the executor and what happens to the house if you both die at the same time." Tess said, "We're trying to get pregnant." Barry Karsten said, "Okay, we'll account for that." Addison had barely been listening, but he had been at the right place at the right time, or as he'd thought of it then, the wrong place at the wrong time. Greg asked him to serve as executor. Since Greg and Tess had both taken the day off from teaching to attend the closing, Barry ended up printing out a boilerplate will for each of them. They all signed. "And you mean to say that Greg and Tess never signed another will?" Addison said. The chief muttered something, throwing in the words, "goddamn careless," but under the terms of the existing wills, the twins got everything anyway. No guardians had been named for the children, and this was the thing that the chief didn't understand. It was an egregious oversight. But the last thing Tess and Greg had planned on was dying. So, put honestly, Addison knew he was the executor of Greg's and Tess's wills, but, like being the permanent treasurer for the class of 1977 at Lawrenceville, he'd forgotten, because he never expected the job to have any responsibilities. Tess's iPhone was suddenly under his jurisdiction. All of the McAvoy property was under his control. He would go through the house, see what was there. He would have free rein over the most intimate nooks and crannies of Tess's and Greg's life, the bank statements, the drawers of the bedside tables, the diaries. It terrified him. Andrea. Twice she had the same dream, then three times. It was such a stupid way to manifest her grief. So cliched and predictable that Andrea was too embarrassed to tell anyone about it. There was no one to tell anyway, since Tess was dead. The dream was real, though. This was to say she was really having it. Once, then again, then a third time with a variation. It went as follows. Andrea was her normal self, sitting in her chair on the beach reading her book. There was shouting from offshore. Someone was drowning. Andrea ran to the shoreline. It was a man caught in the riptide. Andrea motioned with her arms. She shouted, "Swim with it. It will carry you down the beach, but you'll be okay." She was a lifeguard, with a lifeguard's instincts and knowledge. She did not want to go in to save this man. He was too big. In a rip like this, he would take her down. She cupped her hands around her mouth and shouted. She had faith that the man would get it. He would save himself. But he was going under. She lost sight of his face. She started swimming. She reached him, got him under the chin. She could do this. In life-saving class, Andrea had practiced on dummies that weighed twice as much as she did. It was when they were almost to the shore, when Andrea knew they were both going to be safe, that she allowed herself to look at the man's face. He had blue eyes, the most piercing eyes she had ever seen. He was, this man, disturbingly handsome. When they reached shore, Andrea waited for him to thank her, but instead the man turned and walked down the beach away from her. Andrea watched his buttocks in a black Speedo and the triangle of his upper body. His hair was salt and pepper curls. He wore a silver hoop earring. He walked toward a woman lying on a towel, a woman who most definitely had not been present when he was shouting for help in the water. The woman raised her head at his approach. It was Phoebe. Andrea thought, of course, Phoebe. She was heartbroken. Then, seconds later, Andrea and the man, Peter, his name was, he spoke only Russian, though she had no idea how she knew this, were making love against the side of her Jeep. They were, put more accurately, fucking. Because it was wild, tear-at-your-clothes, breathless stranger sex, sex such as Andrea had never experienced in her life. Peter opened the passenger side of Andrea's Jeep. Andrea sat in the seat while he tasted her. The Jeep was the same Jeep she had owned during her first summer on Nantucket. She was confused. She asked Peter where it had come from. In Russian, which she somehow understood, he said, "It's okay, it's your Jeep. You can do what you want in it." Andrea woke up in a panic, her heart shrieking, her hormones raging. She looked at Ed, asleep like a grizzly bear next to her. She filled with guilt. She was riled up, as sexually aroused as she had ever been in her life. Should she wake Ed? And do what? Tell him that she'd had an erotic dream about a man that she'd saved from drowning? A Russian man named Peter who was having a relationship with Phoebe? She thought, he was drowning. Of course he was drowning. But that wasn't what made her sad. What made her sad was that Jeep, the black Jeep she'd bought off the lot at Don Allen Ford in the middle of her first summer, when she was so flush with cash she didn't know what to do with it. She had driven the Jeep from the dealership straight to the ferry dock, where she picked up Tess, who was 15 years old, leaving home alone for the first time. Tess had been wowed by the island, the gray-shingled, cobblestoned quaintness of it, and she had screamed for joy about the black Jeep with the top down. A beach buggy that they could ride in with their dark DeRosa hair flying out behind them. The dream came again 4 nights later, at the end of a particularly brutal day, and Andrea recognized it. She knew what was going to happen. She knew the man would shout for help. She knew she would save him. She knew he would leave her for Phoebe. She knew he would come back to her, and they would mate like wild animals. In the Jeep, with Andrea's legs hooked up over the roll bar, this time there was more shame, more worry. She was worried about indecent exposure. She was worried about the police showing up. The police. Peter said, "It's your car. You can do what you want in it." Once she'd had the dream a second time, it was like a TV show she'd become addicted to, or a novel she was reading. The details plagued and baffled her. She thought about the dream for 4 or 5 minutes of every hour. Peter. Who was he? Andrea had never known anyone like him. But that wasn't possible, was it? Her mind's eye couldn't just create a person out of thin air. Peter must have been a person she'd seen somewhere at some point during her life. He was sitting at a cafe during her semester in Florence. He was in her subway car one of the thousands of times she'd ridden the T. She had seen him with his wife at a restaurant. At Strait Wharf, perhaps, where she and Ed went every year on her birthday. The identity of Peter nagged at her, as did her mounting sexual energy. She and Ed made love when the spirit moved them. Once every 2 weeks, say, normally in the morning when they woke up together and sunlight was pouring through their bedroom windows, or rain was tapping, and Ed found himself with an erection and, being the practical man that he was, decided it shouldn't go to waste. The sex was nice. It was familiar and pleasant. Ed knew what Andrea liked. He got the job done. They had not had sex since Tess died. Ed had assumed sex was the furthest thing from Andrea's mind. She would have thought this way, too, if she were Ed. Plus, they now had two little kids in the house, and whereas Finn slept soundly, Chloe was sometimes up 3 and 4 times in the night, searching the house for her parents. Maybe the lack of sex was to blame for these dreams, then? Maybe Andrea was, at the age of 44, about to hit menopause, and so her body was throwing itself a surprise party? Or it was grief, which, like every other human emotion, revealed itself in ways that made sense and ways that didn't. They were, all of them, drowning. Ed was drowning in work. Andrea was drowning in meanness. Delilah had asked for Greg's guitar. Barney wanted to learn to play it, she said. Although Addison was the executor, a fact that made Andrea feel like she was choking on her son's gym sock, the bag of personal effects from the Coast Guard was at the chief in Andrea's house. What remained were the leather overnight bag and the guitar. The guitar was something of a golden egg. Barney really wants it, Delilah said. He's dying to learn. Andrea had seen Barney, Delilah's younger son, sit at Greg's feet every single time Greg played. He was the most devoted worshiper at Greg's temple. He was probably the only 6-year-old who knew all the lyrics to Bell Bottom Blues. Andrea was not surprised that Barney wanted the guitar. They had all joked about how Barney would be the next Greg. Greg, but famous. Ha! Eric has asked for the guitar, Andrea said. We gave it to Eric. This was not true. Andrea had asked Eric if he wanted the guitar, and Eric said he'd have to think about it. When Andrea asked him again, Eric said he didn't want the guitar. He wasn't musical, could not carry a tune, would be mortified to play in front of anyone. He didn't want it. Give it to someone else, he said. Andrea, frankly, had been glad. She thought Greg's temple was a cult. It sucked you in, but it wasn't real. So here was Andrea drowning in meanness. Barney wanted the guitar. He was the correct spiritual heir. Eric did not want the guitar. Andrea was glad Eric did not want the guitar. And still, she would not give the guitar to Delilah. Despicable. Andrea kept a firm line over the phone, but inside she was cringing at her behavior. Tess had died, and Andrea was turning into a witch. Delilah was upset. She pleaded again on Barney's behalf, but half-heartedly. She hung up without saying goodbye. Andrea supposed she would go to Addison. Get a court order, maybe, for the guitar. Fine. Let her. Andrea had a moment of weakness. Or was it strength? Everything was so inside out she could not tell the difference. She would call Delilah back and offer Barney the guitar. But no, she wouldn't. Andrea's copy of The English Patient, with its cover and the first 18 pages ripped out, lay on the counter. She could still finish it, Ed pointed out, since the part she had yet to read was unharmed. She threw the book in the trash, then started wailing. Didn't he see? Didn't he see the way everything was ruined? Andrea tried to put her energies elsewhere. She tried to focus on the twins. But the twins were like little goblins. They both looked so much like Tess that they scared Andrea. Andrea was losing hold of her sanity. She was frightened by 2 7-year-olds. Looking at them was like looking at Tess, and Tess was dead. She was never coming back. Andrea would never see her again. She was dead. The reality gripped Andrea around the neck like 2 bony hands. She avoided looking at the twins. She was barely able to pour their Cheerios, pack their lunchboxes, and get them to camp. Once they were gone, running from the car, exhilarated by their freedom, Andrea drove aimlessly around the island. She was searching for something. What would help? She pulled into an unfamiliar driveway and burst into tears. She screamed with her fist jammed in her mouth. She went to the grocery store to buy steaks. This was a normal, everyday act. This was what people did when they were alive. They went to the market to shop for food, which they turned into meals. The grocery store was chilly and indifferent. The produce section featured neat pyramids of plums, peaches, nectarines, grapes, wedges of watermelon, knobs of ginger root, bags of coleslaw mix. How could any of this matter? Tess was dead. She was in a coffin, in the ground, not a half mile away. But she was gone. That smiling face, that perky voice, dead. Andrea hurried through the store to the butcher shop. If Andrea had died and Tess was alive, would Tess be able to make a trip to the store? Yes, of course. But Andrea was not Tess. She felt like she was going to asphyxiate. Air. She needed air. She needed to be outside. But being outside felt wrong, too. How could Andrea enjoy sunshine and the breeze when Tess was in the ground? She couldn't be inside and she couldn't be outside. She was a mess. She grabbed 6 ribeye steaks. They were far more expensive than the steaks she usually bought, but who cared anymore about money? Andrea cut down the cereal aisle to the cashier, and bad luck. In front of her in line was Heather Dixon, wife of one of Ed's sergeants, whom Andrea had not seen since this happened. When Heather saw Andrea, her face instantly registered that cross between sympathy and pity that Andrea so detested. Andrea held up a hand, not in greeting, but in traffic cop sign language. "Stop. Please don't speak. I cannot handle the kindest words." Although Heather's husband was a policeman who did occasionally direct traffic outside the Boys and Girls Club, Heather did not pick up on the meaning of Andrea's sign language. She said, "Oh, God, Andrea, how are you? I've been thinking of you." "How am I?" Andrea thought. "I am a stark raving lunatic. Look at me. I can't even draw the breath to answer you. I'm going to try a nod and a whispered lie. I'm okay, thanks." Heather stared intently. She hadn't heard. But she got the message, maybe, that Andrea was losing her marbles and should be dropped like a hot potato. "Please let me know if you need anything," she said as she piled her bags into her cart and rolled out of the store. Andrea stared at the steaks wrapped in plastic. "Need anything?" That night, Ed was late. Casey had been entertaining the twins outside with Frisbee, but she had been promoted to the evening shift at the juice bar and had to get to work. Eric was playing in the adult softball league for the bike shop team. Andrea marveled at the difference between 2 children with their own lives and 2 children who needed everything done for them. Finn, Andrea had learned, couldn't even tie his shoes. "You're 7 years old," Andrea had said, "and you can't tie your shoes?" "Mom always did it," he said. This was true. Tess was guilty as charged. She babied the kids. She did everything for them, even to their own detriment. Finn could not tie his shoes. He could not pick out his own pajamas or pour a glass of milk. Andrea lit the grill. She had too much food. She had not realized that both Eric and Casey would miss dinner. Although, really, she thought, when was the last time either of them had been home for dinner? They were putting themselves outside the house on purpose. They didn't want to be at home with their deranged mother. The flames jumped as Andrea laid the steaks down. Was there a hell? She wondered. Really, was there? She had been a Catholic for 44 years, educated by the nuns and the Jesuits, and this was the first time she'd thought to ask. Chloe came out on the deck, holding a piece of robin's egg blue construction paper folded in half. Andrea took the paper, but did not look at Chloe. "What have we here?" Andrea asked. "A formal request," Chloe said. This should have been enough to make Andrea smile, but it was beyond her. She opened the paper. It had been decorated around the edges with curlicues, flowers, and birds. At the top, Chloe had written, "A formal request. Can we please go to Auntie Dee's house tomorrow after camp and perhaps spend the night?" Andrea was speechless. She resisted the urge to throw the formal request onto the grill flames. It was innocent, she reminded herself. Chloe and Finn wanted to see their friends. But still, the formal request was for Auntie Dee's house. Auntie Dee would cut their grilled cheese into fun shapes. She would permit them to run through the sprinkler until the fireflies came out. The twins did not want Andrea. They wanted Delilah. She couldn't blame them, but it infuriated her. She handed the formal request back to Chloe, not able to look her in the eye. "We'll see," she said. Chloe stood before her for one resigned moment.
"That means no."
"That means we'll see." Chloe fled. Andrea collapsed onto a deck chair and sank her face in her hands. "Need anything?"
"I need Tess back," she whispered.
Denial was such a stupid phase of grief, especially for a 44-year-old woman who had lost both her parents and well knew that death happened to each and every one of us. And yet, at any second, the finality of Tess's death could level Andrea. She wanted to rip her hair out, tear her clothes, get on her knees and beg the sky, "Bring her back." The grill was smoking. Andrea pulled the steaks off just as the chief walked onto the deck.
"Hey," he said, "those smell good."
His voice was light and chipper.
How could he be chipper?
It was 8:20. He had stayed at work for 12 hours. He didn't want to be at home with her either. Andrea stared at the platter of steaks. They did smell good, and they had cost her $70. The grocery store was booby-trapped with landmines. She couldn't stand to see anybody she knew. She didn't want pity or sympathy or understanding. But neither could she tolerate cheerful, normal life moving on. She was falling apart. Couldn't anyone see that she was falling apart? She flipped the steaks off the deck, and they landed in her unwatered perennial bed.
"Jesus," the chief said. He grabbed her arm. "Andrea, what the hell?"
"Need anything?" she crumpled.
That night, after the chief had pulled the steaks out of the garden dirt and washed them off, sliced them thinly, and cajoled both the twins and Andrea to eat, Andrea wandered into her bedroom, lay down on her bed fully clothed, and fell immediately to sleep. She had the dream a third time. The man shouting for help, shouting in a language she didn't understand, but no matter, she understood the urgency. She swam out. She grabbed hold of him. She said, "Just float. I'll get us in. I'm a lifeguard." She noticed his deep blue eyes. And then later, when he was walking away, she noticed his salt and pepper curls, his earring. When Phoebe lifted her face from the towel, Andrea felt her heart break. Of course he belonged to someone else. He belonged to Phoebe. But she felt something else, too. Hope. Anticipation. And there they were, in the jeep, clawing at one another, sucking, biting. He was behind her, but she didn't like it.
"I want to see you," she said. "I want to see your face."
She could feel his fingers on her nipples, his mouth on her neck, but she wanted to see his face. She turned. It was Jeffrey. Delilah. Delilah was the best storyteller. And so she would tell the story of Greg and April Peck, the whole sphere of it. Greg's side, April's side, Tess's side. That was the only way to understand. To hear only Greg's side or only April's side was like taking one slice out of an apple and claiming the rest of it wasn't rotten. Delilah considered herself a neutral third party, a Switzerland, a safe place for either Tess or Greg to go. But really, it was so much more complicated than that. The most frustrating thing about being an adult was, indeed, how complicated everything was. Throw a party,
write a letter to the editor, buy your children a PlayStation, there would be consequences and repercussions you never expected. The Greg and April Peck story was complicated by the fact that Delilah was in love with Greg. Okay, there, she'd said it. She was in love with Greg McAvoy, who was now dead. And would it be flattering herself to say that he had been in love with her, too? Halfway in love? Delilah had been his confidant, his almost lover. They were always this close to crossing the line into that territory. It had started in Vegas, at Le Cirque, with his hand on her foot and then trilling up the back of her leg. This had tipped her off. Greg was interested. His interest made her interested. His interest had, tangentially, been responsible for her taking the dining room manager position at the Begonia. She wanted to be close to Greg, outside of the scope of their group friendship. How? The Scarlet Begonia. Delilah worked four nights a week, most of them nights when Greg played and sang. It was officially impossible to watch Greg up on stage with his dark hair flopping in his eyes and his vine tattoo encircling his biceps and his feet in deck shoes no matter what the weather, and listen to him sing, "You can't always get what you want," and feel anything except powerless against his charms. Every woman in that bar, on any given night, would sleep with him. Delilah placed herself in a distinct category from these women. She was his friend. But just admit it, Delilah. No, it was more than that. To sleep with Greg McAvoy would be a disaster. She had slept with his type before. Nascent rock stars, athletes just off the winning field. They looked at Delilah like she was a juicy cheeseburger, they devoured her, and then they wiped their mouths with a napkin and walked away. She wanted Greg to love her, to value her, someday, more than he valued Tess. They hung out nearly every night after closing. Greg drank copiously and played a private concert for Delilah, Tom and Faith, Graham the bartender, and whoever else happened to be lingering. He and Delilah talked. He told her everything. Or if not everything, then most things. Things he did not tell Tess. It happened organically. They started talking about their kids. Barney had been only 8 months old when Delilah went to work. The twins were a year and a half. Drew was two. Talking about the kids, after a few drinks, morphed into talking about their spouses. How long had it been before both of them realized there was no forbidden territory? Delilah complained. "Jeffrey acts like my father. I did not want to marry my father." Greg complained. "Tess treats me like one of the children. She thinks I am completely incompetent." They were simpatico in their restlessness. And where did this lead them? It led to nights when, at 3 in the morning, Delilah would drive Greg home. Greg would sometimes sit in the passenger seat, oblivious to the world, before stumbling to his front door, his guitar in its case banging into him like an inebriated sidekick. But he would sometimes direct Delilah to Cisco Beach, where they would watch the waves. Greg would tell her how much he wanted to touch her, kiss her, make love to her, and Delilah would stave him off. "We can't. It will end up in such a mess. Our incredible friendship trashed. The guilt will kill you. You don't think so now, but trust me." A few nights he shushed her, his finger, calloused from too many E minor chords, lightly touching her lips. And then he cupped his hand around her neck and pressed his face to her ear. He breathed into her until she thought, "Okay, just this one time, okay." But they had never so much as kissed. Not even one kiss. She held steady. Her body was the Hoover Dam, resisting the force of all that water. It could hurt. It would hurt Tess and Jeffrey and the four little children at home. It would hurt Greg and Delilah's friendship. Once Greg had her, he would weary of her. It wouldn't be as great as he hoped. Whereas, to keep him at bay, to keep him always wanting this thing that was just beyond his reach, was to hold him captive. He sent her love notes on cocktail napkins and cardboard coasters. "You look beautiful tonight. Will you run away with me?" He made her CDs and left them in her car. He sent her text messages from school. "You staying late tonight?" He dedicated songs from the stage. "This one's for you, Ash. because her maiden name was Ashby. He told her dirty jokes. He noticed when she got a pedicure. He said, "You are my best friend." When they were all together, the eight of them, the group, he sent her a signal. Two fingers crossed. You and me, babe. Then came April Peck. Greg had a day job. He was the high school music teacher. It should not have been allowed to put someone so goddamn good-looking with so much magnetism and talent in that position. But there it was. Greg taught music appreciation to all ninth graders. He taught guitar to juniors and seniors. This was mostly boys. And he directed the exclusive all-girls a cappella group, The High Priorities. It was the girls who were the problem. These were girls with voices like angels, with perfect pitch. When a girl made it into The High Priorities, it was fiercely competitive. Tryouts were the first week of May every year, and the whole student body held its breath to find out who made it. She stayed until she graduated. The High Priorities, the 12 of them, were Greg's darlings. They were all in love with Greg. That was no secret. They were his groupies, his harem. They baked him cookies. They left elaborate illustrated notes like, "We heart you, Mr. Mac," on his chalkboard while he was at lunch. They endured painful scales and voice exercises, red leather, yellow leather. They memorized lyrics in 24 hours. Greg lifted his hands and they sang. He brought his hands down and they stopped. All the girls were beautiful, even if they were heavy. And yes, it did seem like the best singers were heavy, or had acne or wore braces or their toes turned in. They were all beautiful when they were on stage in their white jeans and pink cashmere twin sets. They were sassy and sexy. They were luminous, aglow. So much feminine beauty and energy and talent. Those bodies blossoming, those hearts unfolding, the desire and the jealousy and the yearning for praise, for distinction and admiration. God, it was a time bomb. Delilah had warned Greg about this. All those girls with their raging hormones, their new breasts, their asses squeezed into skin-tight jeans, all falling over themselves to make Greg McAvoy happy, to be chosen for solos, to sing like a nightingale. It would get him in trouble one day. He had to be careful. But Greg was careful. Delilah had for years watched him be careful. He taught his girls to sing together, to practice blending their voices. "Harmony," he shouted. "Listen to one another." He agonized over who to give solos to. He never played favorites. "You're all my favorites," he told them again and again. "You're all my highest priority." But teenage girls were fragile. They were both brave and stupid. They were innocent and cunning. A few girls over the years had fallen so in love with Greg they nearly drowned in it. Greg was always kind, always firm, always funny and avuncular. "You feel this way now, but you'll get over it. You'll grow up and shine your light, and I will seem very small and far away to you, I promise." Sometimes the girls showed up at the Begonia for dinner in low-cut tops and lower-cut jeans, and when Delilah told them, at 10 when the kitchen closed, that they had to leave because they were underage, they whined. "I want to see Mr. Mac play. Just one song, please." Delilah had small children at home. She knew how to deal with whiners. "Off you go. Come back when you're 21. "They really love you," Delilah said to Greg. "Yes," he said. "But do you?" Delilah swatted him, sashayed away. People talked about Greg and those girls, but the crushes were innocent and funny. It was an after-school special. Until April Peck. Why April Peck and not some other girl? Like anything, most of it was timing. Delilah had sensed things coming to a head between Greg and Tess. He complained about Tess all the time, and his complaints were angry and mean-spirited. He and Tess were in a rut, sexually and emotionally. The summer had brought the debacle of the roof. Greg dwelled on the roof more than Delilah thought necessary. It was a home improvement project. Could it really fell a marriage? Tess and Greg had had some serious leaking in the spring rains, and they discovered they needed a new roof. They were quoted a price of $37,000 to replace the roof, which they couldn't afford. Greg decided to replace the roof himself. He hired 2 Lithuanian day laborers. He bought 22 bundles of shingles at Marine Home Center. He rented the tools and the ladders, and with a DIY website as his professional reference, he got to work. They spent a week getting the old shingles off and $1,000 dropping them at the dump, then another 2 weeks reshingling in the brutal July sun, only to discover that the roof still leaked and had to be torn off and redone by professionals. Tess did not handle this well. There was a lot of innuendo about the roof caving in on the marriage, literally and figuratively. By the time school started in September, Tess and Greg were depleted, stressed out, and sick of each other. There had been a lot of drives to Cisco Beach to talk that September, a lot of Greg pushing and Delilah resisting. He grew belligerent. You don't care about me. Because I won't sleep with you, I don't care about you? Even you, Greg McAvoy, are too emotionally mature to believe that. I need, he said. What? She said. Something, he said. April Peck was a senior. She had lived on Nantucket for 2 years. She lived with her mother in a huge beach house owned by her mother's parents. There was a father and a brother in New York City. A bad divorce, apparently. The night in question was October 23rd, a Sunday night. According to Greg, things at home had been okay. They were having a fire. Tess had roasted a chicken. Football was on. Tess wanted to read the rest of the Sunday paper and watch 60 Minutes, and she had to make the kids' lunches and get her lesson plans straight for the week. Chloe had a fever of 100.7. Not anything to worry about, but still. They, the McAvoys, had not gone over to Delilah and Jeffrey's house for cocktails and a 6-foot sub for the usual Sunday afternoon drunken free-for-all because of Chloe's fever. If she had something, Tess didn't want her to pass it on to the other kids. Tess also didn't want Chloe to get run down. They were staying home, Tess had told Delilah over the phone, to have a family night. Delilah had been disappointed and a little hurt. Weren't they all family? Greg had not wanted to stay home. He loved their friends and the tradition of the free-for-all Sundays. He loved Delilah and Jeffrey's house. He adored Delilah's cooking. Her repertoire was straight off a sports bar menu, stuffed potato skins, Reuben sandwiches. He loved taking his guitar and getting everyone singing. Sundays, he said, were the days that made him glad to be alive. The drinking, the music, their friends, the kids running around. He could not believe they were turning down a Sunday just because Chloe felt a little warm. 100.7 is more than just a little warm, Tess said. Greg huffed and considered slamming around the house to demonstrate how pissed off he was, but then he got the great idea that he would put the kids to bed and head over to Jeffrey and Delilah's alone. He switched immediately into model parent mode. He got the kids in the bath. He gave Chloe a dose of Motrin. He supervised the toothbrushing and hunkered down with them through 3 chapters of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Downstairs, Tess finished the newspaper, made herself a cup of chamomile tea, and watched 60 Minutes. Greg came down from reading to the kids, but he did not speak to Tess. If he told her he was going to Jeffrey and Delilah's, they would fight. He didn't want to fight. He wanted to be free. He felt like he was shackled to the house. He opened the fridge and got a beer. Tess said, "Are the kids asleep?" Greg said, "What do you think?" He was angry and resentful. He felt like a sullen teenager that Tess had grounded. "Go over there if you want," she said. He did not appreciate the way she'd read his mind. She was so sure she was always one step ahead of him. He said, "I'm going into work." "Work?" she said. "I want to play," he said. "If I play here, I'll wake up the kids." Sheer brilliance. Tess did not like it when Greg played the guitar or the piano at night because the kids did wake up every time. They loved to listen to him and would not go back to sleep until he was finished. "Fine," said Tess, and Greg left. Greg's official version of what happened that night went as follows. He arrived at the school. He played the piano in his room. He figured he had been playing for an hour or so when April Peck walked in. She was wet, he said. Her blonde hair was matted and dripping. The soles of her shoes squeaked against the tile floor. When Greg looked out the window, he saw that it had started to rain. Then he realized April was upset. She was crying. She was wearing a jean jacket and a denim miniskirt. The jean jacket was soaked. April took it off and laid it across his piano. Underneath her jacket, she wore a white t-shirt, which was also wet. He looked down at his hands, arched over the keys. In the unedited version, he told Delilah he knew right then that he was in trouble. He stopped playing. He said, "What are you doing here, April? It's 9 o'clock. April said, still crying, "Play me something." Greg said, "You don't belong in the school after hours without a reason. Do you have a way home, or would you like me to call your mother?" April said, "I don't have a way home. Derek dropped me."
"Why did he drop you here?"
"I saw the light on in your room. I thought you would be here." Greg said, "I'm going to call your mother and have her come get you."
April broke into hysterical sobs. In Greg's words, she threw herself into Greg's arms.
"Meaning what?" Delilah asked.
"Meaning he was sitting on the piano bench and she lobbed herself into his lap."
"So she was sitting on your lap?"
"Sort of, yes. It was awkward. I was trying to get her up, get her off me." Her white t-shirt was wet, and she did not seem to be wearing a bra. He said he patted April's back and then tried to ease her up.
"Up onto your feet," he said. "Let's go."
He said she put her arms around his neck and pressed her breasts against his shoulder. He said he jumped up with such force that he dumped April onto the ground, and she bumped her shin on the leg of the piano. She howled in pain, even though it was just a bump, and couldn't have hurt that much. She said, "I just want to talk to you." Greg said again, "You don't belong here." She said, "I want you to take me somewhere." Greg said, "I'm calling your mother." He dug out the phone book, but the number wasn't listed under Peck. The house belonged to April's grandparents. Greg asked April for the number. She would not tell him. Greg picked April's jean jacket up off the piano and found her cell phone in the pocket. He scrolled through it for her home number. April grabbed for her cell phone. He held it up over his head, and in trying to get the phone back from Greg, she scratched his face. He gave her the cell phone and said, "Fine, you deal with it then." The scratch on his face was bleeding. He ushered April out of the room, turned off the light, locked the door, and headed down the corridor, leaving April behind. April followed him, crying, pleading,
"Take me home. Please don't call my mother. She thinks I'm here with you practicing."
"What?"
Greg said. He was very, very angry now. He was afraid, too, and incredulous. What must April's mother think about a so-called practice at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night? Greg said, "I can't take you home. I've been drinking." As soon as he said it, he realized it was a huge mistake, and it was at that point that he wondered if April had been drinking or if she was on something. He hurried out to his car in the rain. Parked next to him was the car he knew to be April's, a white Jeep Cherokee. He said he peered into the front seat to check that it was indeed April's car, and he saw a bra lying across the driver's seat. He got into his car and drove home, leaving April in the rain in front of the school, crying. "He should have gone home," he said. He should have crawled into bed next to Tess and told her exactly what had happened. But he did not do that, because he did not want to go home to Tess, and he knew that if he told her what had happened, she would blow a gasket. She would find something wrong with the way he'd handled things. Indeed, he felt he'd handled things badly, but the situation had been impossible. Tess would berate him, they would fight, which was why he'd left home in the first place. So he went to Jeffrey and Delilah's. Everyone was still there, Addison and Phoebe, the chief and Andrea. Delilah was buzzed. She'd shrieked enthusiastically when he walked in. She fixed him a plate of food, which he was too agitated to consider eating, but he sucked down a cocktail pronto. Jeffrey said, "Where have you been?" Addison said, "It's Phoebe's Packers, so we decided to stay." Andrea said, "Where's Tess?" "Home with the kids," Greg said.
Chloe has a little fever. Jeffrey said, Are you okay? You look terrible. They all turned to look at him. This, he told Delilah, was the moment when he should have told them what happened. Full disclosure. What happened to your face? Andrea said. She inspected the place where April had scratched him. You're bleeding. He didn't know what to say. At that moment, the real story seemed grotesque and not remotely feasible. The goddamn cherry tree in my yard, he said. I didn't see the branch. Andrea gave him a funny look. She didn't believe him. She thought something else had happened. She thought, what? That Tess had scratched him? Now was the time to set things straight, but Greg didn't want to lend his encounter with April Peck any more energy than it already had. Was there a crime in that? So he lied, and lying begat more lying. It's fine, he said. He cleared his throat. I think I might be coming down with a little something myself. The following afternoon, April Peck filed a complaint with the superintendent's office. April's story went like this. She had left a book that she really needed in her locker, and she had swung by school to pick it up. Luckily, the men's basketball team was playing, and the door to the school was open. Since April's boyfriend, Derek, who had graduated the year before, played in the men's league, she stopped by the gym to look for him, but he wasn't there. She saw a light on in the music room, peeked through the window, saw Mr. Mack, and decided to say hi. She said it had been raining, and Mr. Mack encouraged her to take off her wet jacket. She said Greg patted the spot next to him on the piano bench. I'll play you something, he said. She said she declined. She told him she had just come by to say hi. She had to pick up her book and get home to study. He said, Won't you just stay and listen to one song? No one at home wants to listen to me play. She said she didn't want to, but she agreed. She said she felt self-conscious without her jacket on because her t-shirt was so wet it was see-through and she wasn't wearing a bra. She said that the song Mr. Mack played, Tiny Dancer, made her uncomfortable. She said he was more than singing it. He was singing it to her in a way that seemed to mean something. April said when she went to stand up, Mr. Mack stopped playing, grabbed her arm, and kissed her. She said he tasted like beer. She said he touched one of her breasts through the wet t-shirt. She said she could tell he had an erection. He said, I know why you came here. She turned to leave, to run, and stumbled over the piano bench. She said he reached out for her, saying, Please don't leave. I need. He had her by the arm again. She said she was afraid, so she scratched him hard on the face. She dashed out of the room, out of the school, to her car. She said as she pulled away, Mr. Mack was standing in the rain, calling her name. Delilah heard the two stories in tandem on Monday night. Delilah was horrified. She was, how else could she say it? Crushed. Jeffrey said, We have to support Greg in this. He needs us. This is going to blow up into one of those huge, ugly stories that ruins his reputation. Jeffrey was, as ever, correct. The stories traveled around the island like an infectious disease. Everyone was talking about it. Delilah knew this because for the remainder of the week, wherever she went, the post office, dry cleaners, Stop and Shop, the Begonia, people clammed up when she approached. We have to support Greg, Jeffrey said. He needs us. Delilah was furious. Whereas Tess was heartbroken, devastated, incredulous, and confused, Delilah was just angry. She believed April Peck. Greg said, No one at home wants to hear me play. True. Greg tasted like beer. True. Greg played her Tiny Dancer. This was Greg's favorite song. It was his theme song. It was the best song in his repertoire, his sexiest, most soulful song. It was the song he sang when he wanted something from his audience. It was his seduction song. Greg said, Please don't leave. I need. What? Delilah knew what the next word was. He had said it to her only a few weeks before. Something. Greg was suspended from his teaching position for 2 weeks. Suspended was the word that went around town, with all its negative connotations. Greg was a restless teenage boy who had gone looking for trouble and found it. The school administration called the suspension a temporary leave of absence. Dr. Flanders, the superintendent, who, Delilah knew through Tom and Faith, had more than a few skeletons dangling in his own closet, said, "Mr. McAvoy is taking a leave of absence while we sort the matter out." April Peck took a leave of absence also. Her mother, Donna Peck, who had encouraged April to confront the administration, whisked her away to Hawaii, the Four Seasons, Maui. Delilah felt betrayed. Greg needed something, but why did that something have to be April Peck, a 17-year-old siren with a voice that was a cross between Renee Fleming's and Alicia Keys's? April Peck was too obvious. She showed up at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, a contestant from a wet t-shirt contest and crying to boot, and Greg didn't have the willpower or the common sense to kick her out? Well, he said he did, but Delilah didn't believe him. I need. What Delilah thought was, he was supposed to need me. What certain people knew, Delilah, Jeffrey, Addison, and Phoebe, was that the chief had had a private chat with Dr. Flanders on Greg's behalf. The two men had met in a secret chamber at the police station. The chief either slipped Flanders the equivalent of a maitre d's $50 bill, or he exerted his considerable authority. The chief talked to Flanders as a favor to Andrea, who wanted it for Tess, who wanted it for her kids. This has to get swept under the rug. He can't lose his job. What will we do for money? He has to be fully exonerated. And in fact, the school administration decided to believe Greg. Not in absolute terms, perhaps, but enough to salvage his job and dismiss April Peck from the high priorities. Both Donna Peck and Derek Foster, April's boyfriend, protested this ruling, but they had no clout. Greg had tenure. He had worked in the school for 12 years without incident. He was the father of 2 young children. He was well-respected and well-liked in the community. His wife was a teacher in the district. He was a fine musician and an all-around asset to the music department, and the high priorities were a source of local pride. They had won competitions at the state and national levels. They had traveled to Italy and Luxembourg. And there was the chief of police factor. And what the administration knew that no one else did was that the high school phys ed teacher, Bob Casey, had long been complaining to the superintendent's office that April Peck was lascivious, her behavior in school inappropriate, and dangerous to teachers who were only trying to help her. And, when the superintendent and his inquiry team asked April Peck which book she had gone to retrieve from her locker on the night in question, Sunday, October 23rd, April Peck floundered. Which book?
Which book?
That's the question, Miss Peck. Which book were you coming to school to get?
You mean the title?
The inquiry team frantically scribbled notes. She said,
Why do you want to know that?
It's just a question, Flanders said. We're asking you the title of the book you came to get. Finally, she said,
A separate piece.
Which was required reading for freshmen, not seniors. With news of this primetime flub, the plaintiff caught in a lie, Greg crowed his innocence with a previously unseen confidence and vigor. The girl's a liar. She's been lying all along. What Delilah chose to believe was that Greg was both lying and telling the truth, as was April. The truth fell somewhere in between. The truth was an amalgam of his details and hers. But the truth had been burned in the incinerator. dumped in the ocean 100 miles off the coast. They would never know the truth. For weeks and then months, Delilah was cool and distant with Greg. She had been denying him for years, yes, but for all of those years, she had been in love with him. Surely he realized this. Surely he understood that turning to April Peck would wound her. The cocktail napkins and cardboard coasters that came to her now said, "Do you still hate me?" On stage, he said, "This song is for you, Ash." And it was Natalie Merchant's Kind and Generous. Or it was Landslide, Delilah's all-time sentimental favorite. In February, once the matter was dead and buried in the public eye, and almost so among the eight of them, Delilah said, "You had everyone else fooled, but not me." And he said, "That's too bad. You're the only person who matters." Which sounded like total bullshit, but she was won over anyway. If the story had ended there, it would still have been awful, but ultimately it would have been forgivable. It would have been cataloged under, "We all fuck up. So what?" But then, fast forward almost as far as you could go. There was an endpoint now because Greg was dead. To the night before Greg died, another Sunday night. It was now June 19th, and the Begonia was filled with tourists whom Delilah didn't know. It was a blah night. Delilah was feeling a little flat, a little premenstrual, a little down. Greg and Tessa's anniversary was the following day. They were going on a sail to the Vineyard. They were taking a champagne picnic. Greg was taking his guitar. He had written Tess a song. They were going to stay overnight in a Relais and Chateau property. Fabulous. Would Delilah watch the twins while they were gone? Delilah had a Cinderella complex going. Her ego was hurt, and her heart, and her hopes. 9 months earlier, Greg's marriage to Tess had been looking like a terminal case, but now here it was, rising like a phoenix out of the ashes. She pretended to be happy for them, but she wasn't. At 9:55, April Peck walked into the Begonia. Delilah nearly stumbled in her very high and wicked Jimmy Choos. She was surprised the alarms weren't going off. The little lying bitch alarms. Delilah rushed her. April was wearing a shell pink slip dress embroidered all over with tiny flowers and a pair of expensive-looking silver stilettos. She looked stunning and mature and confident. Nothing like the other girls who had tried to pass themselves off in here. If Delilah hadn't known better, she would have said the girl was of age, or close enough to let slide. But she did know better. "The kitchen just closed, April," Delilah said. "And you're underage, so I can't let you in." April stared. "How do you know my name?" Delilah stared back. What was the savvy answer? The truth? They lived on an island where everyone sort of knew everyone else. Delilah and Jeffrey went to all of the High Priorities concerts to support Greg, so Delilah supposed the first time she had seen April Peck was in the high school auditorium 2 springs earlier. Even among all the lovely songbirds, April Peck had stood out. She was the most beautiful of the beautiful, and she had a solo in Fire. Her voice had been rich and smoky and simmering and strong. Before all this shit with Greg, April Peck had been the kind of teenager adults noticed because she had star quality. And after all this shit with Greg, Delilah was mortified to admit she had stalked April Peck a time or two. Once she had seen April standing in front of the magazine rack at the Hub, paging through Elle. Predictable. And Delilah had lingered on the other side of the store, fingering the polished shells they sold from barrels. She studied April Peck. She deconstructed her. The hair, the jeans, the ass, the breasts, the lips, moving ever so slightly as she read, which made Delilah feel sorry for her. April's cell phone rang. It sounded like the bells of Westminster Abbey, and April answered in her silk sheets voice, "Hello?" She left the store, and Delilah followed her. April Peck was fascinating. Why? She was the object of Greg's desire. Greg had been so bitter and banged up on that Sunday night in October that he might have made a pass at anyone. But it had been April Peck for good reason. She was flawless. Delilah allowed herself a few seconds of sheer envy, then decided she would find a flaw. She followed April Peck up Main Street. April climbed into a white Jeep Cherokee while she was still on the phone. She backed up without looking in her rearview mirror and nearly rammed into a guy in a Ford F-350. The guy opened his window to shout, but then he saw April and whistled instead. There you had it. How do I know your name? Delilah thought. When you pulled a stunt like you did with Greg, you instantly became famous. Surely April realized that. Still, the question threw Delilah. It made her feel defensive and weirdly at a disadvantage. She knew April Peck, but April Peck did not know her. April Peck was a celebrity, and Delilah was a nobody. But this was a ploy by April Peck, a stall tactic. I can't let you in, Delilah said. You're underage.
No, I'm not, April said.
You? April opened her straw clutch purse and produced an ID. A Massachusetts license that furnished her name, April Peck, her address, 999 Pulpus Road, and her birth date, June 1st, 1988, which made her 21 years and 18 days old. Delilah peered at the license closely. It was a fake, of course. It looked real, but it was fake. You're handing me a fake ID?
It's not fake. It's real. I'm 21.
Delilah laughed. You just graduated from high school. I know who you are, April, and I know how old you are.
It's a long story, April said wearily. I don't need to eat. I ate. I just want to sit and listen to Greg play.
Greg. That was a nice touch, calling him Greg. Delilah was wearing a Diane von Furstenberg dress that put her boobs on magnificent display. When she'd walked into the Begonia earlier that evening, Greg had said, "Would you wear that dress every night for the rest of your life, please?" But the dress also stretched tight against the premenstrual bloating at her abdomen. Compared to April Peck in her sleek size zero, Delilah felt like a lumpy cow. She crossed her arms. I'm not letting you in. April Peck exhaled in one long stream to let the world know she was growing impatient.
Call the police. Have them run the license.
She stared defiantly at Delilah.
Be my guest. I'm serious.
Delilah had been fantasizing about a showdown, but now that it was happening, she was uncomfortable. She had been ambushed. She didn't have her footing. It was a tug of war, and Delilah was about to end up face down in the mud. There was a hand on her back. Greg. Let her in, he said. Delilah turned to him, stunned. She's not of age, Delilah said. Delilah, Greg said. Let her in. April sidestepped her way around Delilah and walked into the bar. She took a seat, alone, at the table closest to the stage. Delilah felt like she was watching a horror film. Greg followed April and talked with her for a minute. April said something, and he laughed. He laughed! Then he climbed up on stage, and with a predictable toss of his hair, he sat down in the chair and started singing. Delilah never drank during service. It was a good rule, adhered to even when Addison and Phoebe were in, or the chief, even when a table full of college boys offered to buy her what they called a glass of Chardonnay wine. But now Delilah hip-checked Graham aside and poured herself a goblet of Cabernet and a shot of wild turkey and carried both of them to the ladies' room. She locked herself in the handicap stall and threw back the whiskey first. Awful. Then chased it with a deep swallow of wine. This was hideous, right? Greg had trampled Delilah's authority. He had humiliated her. And for whom? For April Peck bin Laden, the lying bitch seductress with her fake ID. The very same woman, girl, who had trashed his marriage and his reputation. She had nearly cost him his job and his life here, and yet there was Greg defending her, ushering her in, then laughing at whatever insipid thing she'd said. He was up on stage playing for her now. Delilah strained to listen from the confines of the bathroom stall.
tiny dancer. Impossible. But yes, he was singing it. He had not sung that song since the mess with April Peck had occurred back in the fall. But he was playing it now. Delilah sucked down more wine, but the wine only fueled the fire of her rage. It was absconding with the last shreds of patience and understanding that she had left. Should she call the chief? Have him send someone down to charge April with identity fraud? Should she call Tess and say, Greg is on stage right now singing that song to April Peck? The door to the ladies' room swung open, and Delilah could hear Greg singing more clearly. The second verse. The head waitress, Amelia, who was a real hard ass, barked, Delilah, are you in here? Delilah drank more wine. Yeah. Are you planning on coming back out? Delilah left her wine on top of the toilet paper dispenser. She did not want a scene where April became the adult and Delilah the adolescent. Yes, she said. April Peck left at midnight when Greg took his break. She had consumed 3 glasses of Pinot Grigio. One of them, Graham told Delilah, had been comped by Greg. April left a huge tip, $40, which made her queen for a day in Graham's mercenary eyes. April had slipped out while Delilah was in the ladies' room polishing off yet another shot of wild turkey, chased by yet another goblet of Cabernet, and Delilah did not see her go and did not have the opportunity for another parry. Which was good or bad? Good, she decided. She was drunk by closing time. She couldn't do the counting that cashing out required, and so she had Graham do it and slipped him $20 for the trouble. Tom and Faith were at one end of the Boomerang Bar with their 16th or 17th vodkas, and Greg was at the other end, brooding over a Sam Adams draft. Delilah had seen Greg's brooding act a million times before. He used it like a petulant 12-year-old girl. If I make moody, faraway eyes, someone will ask me what's wrong. Delilah had meant to storm out of the Begonia after closing without a word to anyone, but she was just drunk enough to want another drink. Greg was dopily sitting there, and Delilah could not control her urge to vent. She took the stool next to him, asked Graham for a glass of Cabernet, and whispered viciously, I just don't get it. I know, Greg murmured. Have you been talking to her? Sort of, he said. Sort of, Delilah said. She sounded like the indignant wife, the shrew. She was supposed to be the cool girl, the one who could take any news and shrug it off. She came in to talk right before she graduated, he said, and we decided to mend the fence. Mend the fence, Delilah repeated. Put everything behind us. She asked for forgiveness. Delilah narrowed her eyes. She's a liar. Greg sipped his beer. The mooniness was disappearing. Well, she's not 21. No shit, Delilah said. And you made me let her into the bar. I could be fired for that. The Begonia could be shut down. Oh, please, Greg said. I just don't get you. Delilah said. Sure you do, Ash. No, Delilah said. I don't. Were you telling me the truth about that night with April? The whole fucking truth? Yes, he said. I don't believe you. Nobody believes me. I would like you so much better if you just admitted you were lying. I wouldn't even care if you said you fucked her that night, just as long as you told me the truth. Tess feels the same way, Greg said. But I have nothing to add or detract from my story. It stands. And at this point, it is dried up. It is burned, Delilah. There is no reason to talk about it any further. Except that April came in tonight. Like I said, we mended the fence. Delilah's head was spinning. Graham, behind the bar, was a hologram. Tom and Faith were studiously pretending to watch a rerun of Law and Order, which was playing on the TV over the bar, but really, Delilah knew, they were listening to every word. She didn't care. She put her head down on the bar. You have no idea how much I love you, she said. Greg rubbed her back, but his touch lacked intention.
Sure I do, Ash, he said.
He finished his beer and set the glass down with some purpose.
Will you play for me? Delilah asked.
Not tonight, he said. Tonight I have to get home.
Right, she thought. Big anniversary tomorrow. He had made it by the skin of his teeth through year number 12.
He stood to leave, and Delilah stood as well, thinking, change your mind. Stay here, play for me.
Would he change his mind? Sometime before he reached his car, would he call out to her?
He did not. He climbed into his beat-up 4Runner, which was parked down the block from Delilah's Rubicon, and he drove out of town. She did not mean to follow him. They lived only half a mile away from each other, and even though he was way up ahead, she noticed that he did not turn left onto Somerset Lane the way he would have to go home. He kept going straight. He was headed for Cisco Beach.
Was this it, then, her cue? Did he know she was behind him? Was she supposed to follow him?
She checked her cell phone for a text message. Nothing. She followed him anyway, around a bend that gave her vertigo. She put on her turn signal and pulled over to the side of the road. She was very drunk. She should not be driving. If the police got hold of her, she would fail the breathalyzer. She was so drunk she would break the thing.
Greg sped away, oblivious. In so many ways, he was just a boy. What was she doing? She had a man at home, Jeffrey. Jeffrey was too old, and Greg was too young. This was ridiculous. She couldn't chase Greg like this. She had to get home to bed. She had the twins tomorrow, and she liked to be on top of her game when she had the twins. If she gave the kids free run of the PlayStation while she took a nap, Tess would hear about it. Delilah was so drunk, she could not trust herself to be fortress-like with Greg. She would give in to him tonight, of all nights, and it would end up a mess. It would ruin everything. Turn around. Such good advice, but Delilah ignored it. Greg's taillights were two red pinpricks in the distance. And then he rounded the curve by Sandol's fish store and disappeared from view. Delilah followed at a law-abiding pace. She was a cat, Jeffrey always said, because she could see in the dark. It was one of her many unsung talents, and tonight it was a talent she was grateful for. She was 400 or 500 yards away when she spotted two cars parked at the end of Cisco Beach. Two cars. One was Greg's 4Runner, and the other was a white Jeep Cherokee. Delilah swung into the next driveway. A voice was screaming in her head. No words, just screaming. She looked again. She was very, very drunk, an unreliable witness. Yes, it was a white Jeep Cherokee. April's car. Greg had come to Cisco Beach, to their spot, his and Delilah's, to meet April Peck and... what? Mend some more of that fence? Screaming. Delilah backed the car out of the driveway, turned around, and headed for home. She vowed she would never speak to him again. She didn't care what kind of rift it caused within the group. Greg McAvoy was a rat bastard, and Delilah would not speak to him. The next morning, Tess showed up at a little after 9 to drop off the twins. Delilah felt like absolute crap. She had vomited up the contents of her stomach in a lurid Cabernet hue. She had cried and spilled her guts to Jeffrey. She was leaden. Her head ached. Her stomach was puckered like a lemon. Her balance was off. She was exhausted. She had not slept for a minute. She could not stop thinking of the two cars, side by side, and then the imagined scene between Greg and April Peck that followed. Delilah had showered and dressed and made the kids Belgian waffles with caramelized bananas and whipped cream for breakfast. She had to put up a front for Tess. Delilah would take the kids to the beach, then to the farm for strawberry picking, then home to make jam and eat cheeseburgers, and perhaps end the day with ice cream sandwiches, sparklers on the back deck, and a game of Monopoly. Tess, when she arrived with the kids, seemed a little off.
She looked adorable in a red bikini top and white denim shorts, cutesy flip-flops, starlit sunglasses, but her smile was tentative. Something was on her mind. What was it? She was in full apoplectic mode as far as leaving the children was concerned. She kissed them half a dozen times each. She said, "I love you," 14 times, and she came back from the car for one more hug apiece. "I love you so much. Please, please be good. Make healthy choices. I'll be back tonight or tomorrow morning at the latest. Depends on how your father does with the sailing. It's pretty windy." Delilah knew Tess was ambivalent about sailing and every other sport that involved the open water. She said, "Are you nervous, Tess, about the sail?" "Terrified," Tess said plainly. She met Delilah's eyes with what felt like an indecent amount of honesty. Delilah hung in the balance for a suspended moment. Shouldn't honesty be met with honesty? She couldn't bear to think about it now. Could not bear it. Delilah's decision could not be taken back, any more than Greg's indiscretions could be taken back, any more than Tess and Greg could be brought back from the dead. It was all over and done. And yet the whole mess festered in Delilah. Physically, she was healthy, but her emotional state was frayed. 2 weeks after Greg and Tess died, she had nearly caused 4 catastrophic car crashes. She drove, but she did not pay attention. She did not sleep. Phoebe gave her enough Ambiens to euthanize an army battalion, and still she did not sleep. She was tired all day with the kids. She dropped the boys off at camp and then had to set the kitchen timer to remind herself to pick them up. She did not have the energy for fishing or hiking around Quay's swamp or taking a kayak off the jetties. She gave the kids too much money for the snack bar, or she dropped them at the movies, and then she sat listlessly in her car for 2 hours with the air conditioning on, watching people go into and come out of the begonia. She had not given Tom and Faith an answer about her job, but she would have to tell them soon that she was not coming back. She stopped cooking. Every night it was pizza or prepared food from the farm. And she had stopped drinking. This last change may have sounded like it was for the best. Better, certainly, than Delilah drinking herself into a coma every night. But Delilah's relationship with alcohol had always been positive. And now alcohol was one more thing she couldn't bring herself to enjoy.